Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The American Southwest, desert America, was cowboy and Indian country in the old pop culture treatment. Today, it's headline news, heat, fire, immigration, housing, drought, culture clash. It's all there. Ruben Martinez knows it very well, high and low across the board. This hour On Point, Ruben Martinez on what's really going on these days in desert America. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Is this your part of the country? Hot, dry, desert? Where it's headed? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will look at the U.S. Senate and the huge border security package that's got everybody talking there. But first, the great Southwest, the big, big story in this last week has been heat. Here's a little bit, newscasters and tourists taking it on. Record-breaking heat.
Tonight, the worst day yet. Relentless heat in the Southwest reaches its peak, with some locations hitting 120 degrees or more.
The casualties continue to mount. In Southern California, authorities announced that six runners who braved a half marathon had to be hospitalized for heat-related injuries.
The strip is sweltering, and tourists like Sharon Martin, looking to stay cool, are out of luck.
We're from Pittsburgh, and it's very, very hot here. Feels like it's 120 degrees. It's very hot.
Again today, heat warnings and advisories are posted for parts of eight states as temperatures soar into the 110s, even towards the 120s in the desert Southwest.
And that's just the thermometer. There is a lot going on in this big corner of the country. Joining me now is journalist Ruben Martinez, professor of literature and writing at Loyola Marymount University, artist in residence at Stanford University's Institute for Diversity in the Arts. His latest book, just out in paperback, is Desert America, A Journey Through Our Most Divided Landscape. His 2001 book, Crossing Over, is also out as a reissue. Today he's in San Francisco. Ruben Martinez, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
This is really a wonderful, deep dish look at this part of the country, and I want to dig into it, but just respond to some of the things in the headline with us for a second here, Ruben. You know this part of the world so well. These heat headlines in the last week, all-time record in Death Valley for one day early in the last week and all over the place. How do you look at that? More, you know, desert heat as usual or something new here, Ruben?
Both. It's always been a place of extremes, and it's always been a place that serves as metaphor, even as it's a real physical material place. In other words, here we've got extreme heat, 129 degrees in Death Valley, 117 degrees on the Strip in Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
Even here, I'm in the East Bay in the Bay Area, yep. San Francisco Bay Area, and even here it was pushing 90 degrees, which is tremendous for this part of the country. So on the one hand, you know, the material physical experience of it. On the other hand, it's also a tailor-made metaphor. It just so happens that the immigration debate has reached critically hot levels,
yes,
in terms of the rhetoric, the hot gas, if
yes,
you will,
yes,
coming from some quarters. So the desert stands as a place, and it stands as a profound symbol that reaches deep into our history as humans.
Another big headline this week in a tragedy, 19 dead firefighters in Arizona. What do you think about that? How are you responding to it?
It's the result of many years now of the climate that is – it might sound like a redundancy, but it bears stating. Desert drought is a hellish redundancy. There is such a thing as desert drought. The desert is an incredibly fragile ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
If you push it just – and you blow upon it and the thing just falls apart. It does rain in the desert, of course. You know, those of us who live in the Southwest know the monsoon rains come. It's a place of tremendous aridity. But when those monsoon storms come, the thunderheads, you know, billowing up into the afternoon, there can be one moment it's 117 degrees. The next moment there's a flash flood roaring down the arroyo. And that water that comes mostly in the summertime from the monsoon rains is what, of course, serves to sustain life. But in the last several years, we've had historically low levels of precipitation. There are places of the Southwest and even on the coast that have received in some years less precipitation than the Sahara Desert.
Yeah.
So all that sets up a situation for mega fires. And the fire in Yarnell burnt hot and fast and unpredictably. The winds shifted. And it's part of these historic blazes that have been burning throughout the West for several years now. Just in the last few years, there have been historic blazes in Texas, Arizona, California, and New Mexico. That's just what appears to be the beginning, according to the experts.
We loved your book, Desert America, when it came out, and we just didn't manage to get to you and to it. But it's out in paperback now, and we thought, what a great time with everything going on there. It's written out of your experience of years living all over the South, really, in hot desert places, but 29 Palms in Joshua Tree, California, up in Velarde, New Mexico, in Marfa, Texas. Desert America, indeed. And your subtitle, A Journey Through Our Most Divided Landscape. What division or divisions are you talking about there, Reuben?
Take your pick. It's a long list between the high and the low in terms of the economy, certainly. Boom and bust cycles are endemic to the Southwest, of course. The old 19th century economies of oil and ranching and silver and copper and gold, those were economies that rushed really, that turned really hot, you know, really fast and made fortunes for a few and left a lot of others out in the cold. In the 20th century, by and large, those what they call the extractive economies have waned. Cattle ranching has waned throughout the area as well. But what seems to have replaced it is just speculation. In other words, real estate. And in this most recent, you know, cycle for the national economy of the boom, the Southwest experienced some of the highest foreclosure rates in the country and some of the highest unemployment rates. Think Las Vegas, Nevada. Think Phoenix, Arizona. These are places that saw explosive growth in terms of their urban development, which also, by the way, had an impact on the ecosystem, which is part of the mix that leads to this highly combustible landscape because of human development encroaching upon fragile wilderness areas.
There's division by what? Boom and bust. There's division by wilderness or development. You've also got plenty of cultural division that you're writing about here.
Yes, everywhere. I lived off and on in the desert areas for a decade, and I'm still deeply connected to them. And everywhere I went, there was some sort of culture war going on. History on this landscape is not something abstract. It's not something you need to go to a museum for. When I lived in Velarde, New Mexico, on the what they call the low road between Santa Fe and Taos, which, you know, many of your listeners probably know, is a spectacularly beautiful landscape. Yes. Of mesas and buttes and the stratification of millennia, you know, going up and down the Taos Gorge and the Rio Grande. That's you know, a place that Ansel Adams and Georgia O'Keeffe have rendered. Well, it's a beautiful landscape, but on that landscape, the human presence is incredibly troubled and contested. They call New Mexico the land of enchantment, but it's also a land of tremendous disenchantment between Native American, on the one hand, and Hispano, as they call themselves, Latinos call themselves there, and Anglos. There's three cultures that are, by and large, at each other's throats, divided also by economic iniquity.
You've got a Mexican, American father, Salvadoran mother. You know both sides of that border and well down into Central America. How do you identify across this sort of fluid landscape of culture now, Reuben?
Yes, I grew up the way you put it. I suppose I grew up on a kind of border myself between, you know, different peoples and languages of Central America and Mexico. I mean, the way we speak Spanish in El Salvador is very different from the way we speak it in Mexico. And so I grew up navigating between, you know, the cultures in my own family. And I guess that set me up to be able to navigate, you know, the broader, you know, divisions that we have up here. But it also kind of, I mean, it's a great and terrible thing to grow up on this metaphorical and literal border, right? On the one hand, it gave me the facility to recognize difference and embrace it where possible. But it's also, I've on this landscape, I'm never completely at home. I'm always slightly an outsider. When I lived in Velarde, New Mexico, my Hispano brethren were constantly reminding me that I was a recent arrival, that I might as well have been, you know, the latest New Yorker coming
out. Tried to
out.
Run you off the road in your Subaru.
Exactly. I did have a neighbor that tried to run me off in my Subaru, yes. And I was constantly reminded that my neighbors had roots in the area going back 11, 12 generations, back to the 1600, the end of the 1600s. In many cases, land grants that were given by the King of Spain. People could pull out these dusty, you know, titles and show how long, you know, that land had been in those families.
So never mind the Latino, or, you know, you call yourself a brown cowboy. Skin didn't matter here. It was, they had 11 generations and you had 11 minutes.
Right. I imagined solidarity between us, but that was in my imagination, not theirs. I was just another Birkenstock Subaru driving
and that's
outsider.
Even, right, that's even before we get to Anglo, Chicano, you name it, all the rest. Ruben Martinez, we're really glad you're with us just in this season. These issues are so high and hot. Here's Los Tigres del Norte. Somos más Americanos. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back with Ruben Martinez. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about desert America, the hot West in boom and bust, and now the reality behind the postcard out West, sort of road tripping on the Southwest desert's borderlands with Ruben Martinez. His book is Desert America, A Journey Through Our Most Divided Landscape. Out and out again now in paperback. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. He has lived all over this area for a long time that takes up so much of our headlines these days, whether on immigration or weather or climate, you name it. In reality and in our national mythology, it is absolutely beautiful. It is in so many corners. Ruben points to something that Breaking Bad picked up on, the Emmy-winning TV series. There's a tough underside. Maybe it's everywhere, but here's a little bit from the first season of Breaking Bad, cooking up methamphetamine to provide for the family. You know, perfect place, that desert, for a little criminal activity.
What if we rented one of those self-storage places? You know, those little orange garages worked out of there.
No. They're onto that. They got dogs that sniff around. It's RV. That's what you want.
What, like a Winnebago?
Yeah. You know, I know a dude who wants to sell his. He just goes camping with it. But a mobile meth lab? That'd be the bomb. I mean, drive way out in the boonies. Be all evasive.
Mobile meth lab? That would be the bomb. Ruben Martinez joins us today from Berkeley, California. He knows the whole region. You know, Ruben, you remind us. I mean, you grew up with this kind of Jimmy Stewart, John Wayne, Gene Autry, Sons of the Pioneers, Marty Robbins sensibility. A little embarrassing to you now, you're right, but that was running through your head too, even as a, you know, a Mexican-American. But you write a lot, and we heard just in that clip, there's a lot of tough stuff here too, plenty of grimy.
Oh, yes. I grew up with the old Western, let's say, through my dad. My dad was born in East Los Angeles, raised across the border between Mexico and the U.S. And, you know, for a kid in the 1940s and early 50s, the Western was at its peak. Yeah. So when I was growing up, my dad was, you know, feeding me the pop culture of his youth, which included, you know, John Ford Westerns. The Searchers was a favorite in our house. And music like the Sons of the Pioneers or Gene Autry, Marty Robbins. I think for a lot of Mexican-American families, the country western thing is one of our best-kept secrets. We're embarrassed to admit it. But there's Freddie Fender, who brought it all together and made it okay for us. Walter White and his sidekick Jesse of Breaking Bad are like the new western. I've been an avid follower of the series. I've been watching it slowly on Netflix over the last couple of years. Yeah. And I'm fascinated by it because it also, you know, touches upon one of the big border stories, which is the drug war between the United States and Mexico, which doesn't make headlines very often. It's just kind of like this, you know, white noise, mm-hmm. as it were, you know, in terms of border news. But for immigrant families on this side of the border, the violence of the last several years in Mexico has had a devastating effect. The brilliance, the genius, I think, of Breaking Bad is that it makes the story an American story. It's very simple to say that it's the Mexican drug war, you know, that it's the barbaric something going on mm-hmm. down south mm-hmm. That's close to the border and that's a little scary, but it's a Mexican thing. Breaking Bad tells us that it's American as apple pie in the end. Who could be more American than Walter White, right? And his sidekick Jesse in that RV out on the far desert plain.
Yeah, no kidding. I want to get a reading from your book and get a little sense of you in those desert communities that can be so wonderful and so fragile at the same time. Ruben Martini is with us. His book is Desert America. Let's take a call from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Eric is calling. Hi, Eric, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I am a third-generation gringo from Albuquerque.
Okay.
And I've seen it grow so quickly, so dramatically, especially since the 80s when people from California started to move to Santa Fe and buy up all the property, and the West Mesa has just disappeared, a place where we used to go, you know, walking around Mesa and getting our cars stuck in the dirt.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if there's any moves, or if you or your guests know of any moves to set up some limitations on the number of people that can live in these areas, because despite them being so vast, the carrying capacity is quite small.
Hey, Eric, we'll go to that, but stick with us because I've got another question for you as well, Eric. Stick with us in Albuquerque. Ruben, what about limits here? I mean, water, carrying capacity, we've heard about it for years, and yet, mm-hmm. you know, Phoenix has got the biggest bump up in home prices in this last report.
Indeed. Yeah, that's scary to me because it really feels like we're going down the same path we did in the 2000s. And I just also wanted to shout out to Eric in Albuquerque, who mentioned the West Mesa that I'm very familiar with because my mother-in-law, Wilma Garcia, lives there and we visit all the time with our family, of course. And we're heading there actually in a few weeks.
Great.
And my mother-in-law bought a place, put a trailer on it, 1 acre of land on the West Mesa. And when she bought about 15 years ago, she was the only house for hundreds of yards around. And she was basically the last house out on the West Mesa.
Yeah.
Today, she's completely surrounded by subdivisions on all sides, and some of which, you know, was stalled during the boom. Mm-hmm. So you have, you know, families that moved into a lot of places, but then these half-constructed kind of ghost subdivisions on the Mesa, and it captures perfectly the whole boom and bust cycle that we just experienced. As far as limitations on growth, by and large, municipal elections in the last several cycles, including Albuquerque, have swung in the direction of pro-growth advocates. Mm-hmm. It's on the rhetorically, it's difficult to be a no-growth candidate during the boom cycle because you're kind of raining on the parade. And it's hard to be a no-growth or slow-growth candidate during the bust because the rhetorical attack is simple. You go, oh, you're against jobs then. Right.
Yeah.
But the fact is that we have to have a holistic approach that takes into account what development is doing in terms of the natural, the rural-urban interface that we've been talking about, and also what is really sustainable in the West long term. Mm. Do we really want to go through another bust like we just experienced, and we just saw those numbers from Phoenix spiking again?
Yeah.
Well, what comes up must come down. Is there a way to plan long term for the economy that avoids these run-ups and crashes?
Eric, you're third generation there. What are you think is sustainable in the long term? You're in Albuquerque. What do you think, Eric?
Well, clearly not what's going on. I mean, you see in a town called Gallinas, the Native Americans who have a casino nearby are stealing water rights, even though if you go back in time, of course, they're entitled to them, but they want to keep their golf courses watered. And you have, if you had rules like no front lawn, no swimming pool, limitations on building, no golf courses, there shouldn't be a golf course in New Mexico. It's ridiculous. California and Arizona are taking our water, and we're giving it to them. There needs to be a limit. And what makes New Mexico precious and these areas precious is that there has always been just a limited number of people, and there was actually, despite what your guest said, people did get along quite well, the Latinos and the Gringos and the Native Americans. But the way that it's growing is creating a lot of enmity, a lot of anger and frustration, you know, roads being built through neighborhoods that never had major roads, like Montaño, was very upsetting to a lot of people, albeit those people were quite wealthy. It just, you know, I love it. People who live there love it. But it's just like if everyone could move to Florence in Italy and everyone loved it so much, eventually you'd run out of space.
Yeah, we've got a Peter writing to us on a website here saying the Southwest can be beautiful, but folks with money can make the oasis a mirage. Well, I mean, it can become a mirage in lots of ways. And one more for you, Eric. Well, we've got you from Albuquerque. I don't know, as a third-generation gringo, you describe yourself. I don't know how good your Spanish is, but the music we had at that last out, Los Tigres del Norte, and, of course, they're singing in Spanish, but in English it's among brave warriors, Indians of two continents mixed with Spaniards, and if we take centuries into account, they're singing there on MTV Unplugged, they sing, we are more American. We are more American than the children of the Anglo-Saxon. Third-generation gringo, Eric, what do you think about that?
I have always felt like a guest there and been honored to be there. We're Jewish, and a lot of Jews left Europe right before, you know, when things were not good for Eastern European Jews. So we were quite happy to be there. And although we homesteaded, you know, land that we no longer have that land, because at the time we thought, no one wants to move here. But we've always felt honored to be part of the community, and we treated it with respect. And my grandfather was an active member in helping people.
Eric,
so, we're gringos.
Well, hey, what exactly that means and meant and is going to mean among the whole welter of people there, we'll see. Eric, I'm so glad for your call from Albuquerque. Ruben, what about that? What about our, you know, the song here? We're more American than the children of the Anglo-Saxons. Where does that go, cross-border man?
Absolutely. A brilliant choice of music from Los
Your Tigres suggestion, Norte. And, thank you.
Yes, indeed. That particular song, by the way, also includes a special guest joining Los Tigres del Norte, an L.A. homeboy named Zach De La Rocha.
Okay.
Your anarchist punk friends, listeners of the show, will recognize that name. That will know that name immediately. He's the lead singer for Rage Against the Machine.
Mm-hmm.
And he, born and raised Chicano, Mexican-American, on this side of the border, joins his brothers, Los Tigres del Norte, who are from Mexico, of course, but for many, many, many years have lived in San Jose, California. So talk about a border experience. I mean, they're crossing the border constantly. There is at home on this side as on the other side, and commercially, you know, sell millions of albums on both sides of the border as well. And in terms of their bedrock message, somos más americanos, we are more American, that's a little tongue-in-cheek, I think. You know, it's not really a contest to see who's more American, but it is claiming back that Americanness that's been denied so many peoples of the border, whether they're the Buffalo Soldiers, whether they're the Native Americans, all the people who've been on this landscape who've been stripped of their humanity through the various conquests over the cycles of centuries over the years. Well, they're saying, no, we belong in this landscape. It is a diverse landscape, John Wayne iconography notwithstanding. It is a diverse landscape and becoming ever more so diverse. And that's what swung the election ultimately in November, that saw Obama go back to the White House without the Western states, Colorado and Nevada and New Mexico, swinging into the blue column decisively because of the Latino vote. Barack Obama would not be in the White House again.
Sure. I mean, you say tongue-in-cheek, but is it really? I mean, there's been a denial of history in the past, no doubt. There's been a denial of rights. Sometimes these days, even as we talk about building this massive fortification on the border, there's also a denial of the border.
Oh my gosh, there is, yes, and that's probably the story that's right now the white hot story on the border. And I consider myself a son and grandson of the border. My grandparents crossed it, my father crossed it, my mother crossed it, and my brother, sister, and I crossed it many times growing up on vacations to going to Mexico to visit family. The way the border is being talked about in Washington, D.C. has no relation whatsoever to the way the border is experienced here in our southwestern and northern Mexican borderlands. When they talk about a border surge, when they talk about bringing Black Hawk helicopters down, when they talk about doubling the size of the Border Patrol, when they talk about doubling the length of the border fence, it's as if our neighboring country is ruled by the Taliban. Our neighboring country is called Mexico. Our neighboring country... on the border, we bleed into Mexico economically and culturally. Mexico bleeds into us economically and culturally. That's been a long-standing reality. There's no wall, ultimately, that can really divide this culture. This culture, like Los Tigres del Norte, like Zac de la Rocha joining them, cannot ultimately... be divided by that wall.
Ruben, just listen. Here's a couple of clips from down that way. Here's a South Texas rancher, Juan Mercado, talking with CBS in May.
I'm being invaded by people who have no permission to be on my property, by smugglers, by illegals.
And here's a South Texas Border Patrol agent, Chris Cabrera, talking with CBS News.
Once the first group comes across, they call the family, they call their friends, and let them know that, hey, the time is right. Come on over.
You know that tension, Ruben, and it is still very much there. And yes, it gets magnified and maybe twisted and played out in Washington, but it's real.
It is real, of course. Ranching families that have their fences undone by smuggling, that's real. The Border Patrol taking rocks from smugglers, you know, rocks being hurled almost as if it was, you know, in the Middle East, that's real too. Of course it is. But... most people on a daily basis don't experience the border as this hardcore, violent, scary place. Most people on the border, how many people have border crossing cards that go, how many people actually conduct commerce across the border? How many trucks through NAFTA are coming across the border? And of course, culture and the internet know no borders, and American pop is as deeply embedded in Mexico as Mexican pop is so deeply embedded on this side of the border. And I think our American pop has been showing that in recent years, the way it's developed, the way we have Eva Longoria, you know, is a household name these days. Salma Hayek. I mean, this is a long-standing cultural collaboration across that border, and the wall cannot deny that reality. And ultimately, I hope the politicians of the border who live this reality day in and day out will get their message across that what's being promoted as the border surge is a colossal boondoggle that will put $40 billion into the hands of contractors like Halliburton, like all the other contractors that we know that are called upon in situations like this to build their Black Hawk helicopters and so forth. I'm astonished, actually, that so many Republicans have signed on to this idea, spending this amount of money for something that clearly hasn't worked in the past and will not work in the future.
We're going to talk about that $40 billion package outlined by the Senate anyway at the U.S.-Mexican border. Ruben Martinez is with us, author of Desert America, A Journey Through Our Most Divided Landscape. There's a wonderful excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Here's the desert rock band Queens of the Stone Age, based out of Palm Desert in Joshua Tree, California, with the song No One Knows. Known for throwing parties out in the desert, powered by generators, the gritty sound lyrics often contain themes of that aimless life and hard drugs in the American Southwest. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Deadline.
talking this hour about desert America, the hot West in boom and bust, and now the reality behind the postcard out West. Sort of road tripping here on the Southwest Desert Borderlands with Ruben Martinez. He is author of Desert America, A Journey Through Our Most Divided Landscape. And you can see that division in many ways. Over a decade and more, he was out in, Joshua Tree and 29 Palms, California, desert territory. Marfa, Texas, same. Up in New Mexico, also pretty darn hot and dry. Lots of response online here, Ruben. Wonderful, wonderfully written book, by the way. But here's one listener who says, lots of family. He's got lots of family in Tucson. He says, every time I get off the plane, I say I'm not going back east, ever. But I always do, and it's all about the water and how much there is back in the east and not in the southwest. But he says the desert is awesome. There's another. Peter says, I hope Mr. Martinez will come to Changing Hands in Tempe, Arizona, and speak about all this. So many in Phoenix, this listener writes, still have their heads in the sand on sustainability, I guess, as On Point's interview with Grady Gamage Jr. proved. We talked with him. Wonderful sense of what's going on there. And then here's one more, kind of goes to the down and dirty side that you describe plenty, with respect. It says, Tom, the movie Off the Grid, Life on the Mesa, seems like it would be relevant to this discussion. Bunch of people living rogue on the fringes of a desert in the southwest. I guess they're back from a 2007, Jeremy and Randy Stolberg. You know a little bit of that rough and edgy life, Ruben. I mean, you say people go to the desert to sort of clean up and sometimes watch, look out for a little spiritual rebirth. You took a little drug issue of your own to the desert when you first went.
That is how Desert America begins. It's a very personal journey. I happened to be writing or trying to write a book in Mexico City. Typical writerly tale. I was lucky enough to have an advance to write a book about migrants. Had spent the entire advance and didn't have a single word written.
Ouch.
Part of the reason was that I was in trouble. I was in trouble with drugs and wound up going to the desert. I had some friends living in Joshua Tree, California. They said, come, we'll help you get your life back together. And I did. I wasn't particularly reflective at that moment. I was just, kind of like in survival mode. But slowly over a period of years, I realized that I was entering into a very deep kind of spiritual lineage of the desert as a place for healing pilgrimage. This is very, very deep in Judeo-Christian and Muslim tradition. The desert is a place of pilgrimage. It's a holy place. It's sure. A fragile, beautiful, sublime place.
Strip it all
place.
Away and find something greater, maybe.
Yes. And so many of the issue is that, number one, so many of us are going out there to clean up that we're bringing a lot of ghosts with us,
Demons.
Demons. And maybe this is kind of like the 21st century version of what St. Anthony, of the desert was finding in the Egyptian desert of the 4th century. It was the same kind of thing. People getting away from the overpopulated Nile River Valley and going out to the desert to find themselves. Well, we bring the ghosts of our troubles with us, number one, which makes for some scary encounters. And number two, we're heading out onto a landscape that's already populated with so many ghosts from the conquests, the bloody scrim of manifest destiny, the conquest of Spanish over native, and conquest by other means. Some people would say that conquest today is called gentrification. On the rural landscape, we see it as much as on the urban landscape. Newcomers, the 1% with a lot of money coming in and upsetting, what is a fragile social ecology as well as natural place. Mm. So it's kind of complicated to have just a simple, pure spiritual pilgrimage in a place that's so complicated, and so troubled.
Yeah.
But I think we want to save that part of the desert. And that's, I think, where we can all kind of maybe come together. The idea that we're living unsustainably. The desert is teaching us this lesson with the wildfires, the tragedy of the firefighters in Yarnell a couple of days ago. It's telling us that we need to find another sustainable way of living. And that means in the ecological, environmental sense, that means in the social and economic sense. We do not want to repeat the mistakes of the very, very recent past with that most recent boom and bust.
But we may be lined up to do just that. Noe in Somerville, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Noe. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm calling because I actually am from Yuma, Arizona, a border town right on the crossing of the Colorado River, California, Arizona, and
sure.
Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I wanted to bring to the conversation was policy, but particularly education policy. And the reason that I left the Southwest was a lack of educational opportunities for me and the people around me, and particularly policies in Arizona that keep people from being able to reach what is ultimately the avenue by which we can achieve sort of the American dream in whitewashing sort of education. And if you look at the policies in Tucson.
Whitewashing, do you mean English-only education? Is that what you mean by that?
Yeah, English-only education in schools, sending home letters to kindergartners that are only in English to parents who only speak Spanish, talking about policies that their kids need for things like immunization. In Tucson, state senators trying to banish or make against the law to teach Mexican-American literature or culture classes in high schools as electives, and just generally keeping funding from schools, taking funding out of public schools that is further marginalizing an entire population of young people and their parents from achieving education, which if we can have those conversations between people and children and parents and perhaps bridge a lot of these policy issues and cultural and sort of religious gaps that seem to be such a foundation of the misconceptions or misperceptions of the Southwest.
No, Noe, I'm so glad you raised that. Let me take it to Ruben, if I may, and thanks for your call. I mean, this is a great way to go out, but you know, we can talk about potential calamities here. We can see some right now, see some this week. But look at the future for a minute, Ruben, from your perspective, and people have all kinds of perspectives. You know, what's the best future we could look to here, environmentally, culturally, in the great desert Southwest?
Well, to paraphrase Los Tigres del Norte, who are saying somos más americanos, why don't we say todos somos americanos, that we are all Americans on all these sides of the border that we share. The border can be a place, a scary place of division, but it can also be, and it is, a place of encounter. Noe's comments about education are well taken. It is a tragedy in Arizona today that the educational system is hostage to a political fight, a culture war, which, yes, has led to the banning of the teaching of Mexican-American studies in public schools in Tucson, for example. And Tucson, to say that you can't teach Mexican-American studies in Tucson is like saying you can't eat a quesadilla, you know? I mean, how to not be able to talk about the very history of the place, the people that live there is an astonishing move.
In a place that was Mexico.
That was Mexico, and that is America in the broadest possible sense, America in the Whitman-esque sense, right, that speaks all these different ways, all these different accents.
But does it hold together if you open it wide up to all its history? Is it all containable in one country's boundaries, mind?
Yes, it is. And I think my children, who are Greek, Jewish, German, Salvadoran, Mexican, and are bilingual, they bear that out. Ruby and Lucia, a shout out to my daughters.
Okay, Ruby and Lucia, we wish a beautiful future to them, to all of us. Ruben Martinez, you enrich our sense of this place that gets reduced to thermometer readings and firefighter death tolls and shouting matches in Congress, and we are grateful to you for that. The book is Desert America, A Journey Through Our Most Divided Landscape. Ruben, in California, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom, for the conversation.
Wonderful to have you with us. In a moment, we go to the immigration debate and what's on the table for Southwest border security. This is On Point. Border security has been the talk of Washington in these last few weeks. The Senate passed a gigantic $40 billion security package to win Republican votes for passage of an immigration bill. This scale and detail in the bill turned a lot of heads. With us right now is Matea Gold, staff writer for The Washington Post. She's covered the Senate's border security package and more. Matea Gold, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
There was already a lot of money in the pipeline for border security, but the Senate pumped it way up. How big, Matea?
So they added another $38 billion in the final week. And the political backdrop, which you alluded to, was really a drive to increase support for Republicans among Republicans for this plan and have it come out of the Senate with so much momentum that it would hopefully spur some movement in the House, where really I think the prospects for a comprehensive immigration overhaul are much more grim. They fell just short of the 70 votes that they were seeking, despite adding $38 billion in border security spending. And so we took a look at some of that spending. And what was really remarkable is that buried in the 1,200-page bill is some very unusual language that mandates the purchase of specific equipment by brand and model that would be used as part of this border surge.
That sounds like old-fashioned earmarking, kind of a pork barrel politics. Specific companies that are targeted that we're going to buy this company's, I don't know what, you tell us.
Well, it is reminiscent of that. I think one of the key differences is there's no connection really between the companies that would benefit from this legislation that we've been able to find and the sponsors of the bill, Bob Corker and John Hoeven. I think what this was really a case of was kind of a politics making its way into the policy. And what happened was that they were really encountering stiff resistance among their GOP colleagues for backing this, and primarily because a lot of Republicans wanted to be able to go back to their district and brag about having beefed up border security at an unprecedented level. So to overcome and assuage some of the GOP concerns about whether this measure would, you know, be tough enough on border security, they actually borrowed language from the Border Patrol's own kind of spreadsheet of their technological wish list of what they would need to kind of ideally secure the border. And they kind of cut and paste the list of technology and equipment they wanted and put that directly in the legislation. In the process, they, you know, listed items like Black Hawk helicopters and this new Vader radar system that Northrop Grumman has developed. And so those things found their way into the bill, I think, almost unintentionally, and but now are drawing a lot of scrutiny.
15 Sikorsky Black Hawk helicopters, sort of the very latest, $17 million apiece for those, 6 Northrop Grumman airborne radar systems, $9.3 million apiece. Specific, you know, companies named here, American Eurocopter, a bunch of their helicopters, $3 million apiece. And right on, 17 UH-1N helicopters from Bell Helicopter. And that's just the stuff in the sky. You mentioned the Vader, as in kind of Darth Vader radar system. What is that?
It has an ominous sound, it does. But
spell that Vader way.
The Vader radar system is a airborne radar system that Northrop Grumman developed originally for the Pentagon's research arm. And, you know, one of the things is the defense sector is really looking for new opportunities now that there's less of a demand for equipment in Afghanistan. And so they, you know, The Border Patrol borrowed one of these systems from DOD to test it, and it's a radar system that you attach to an unmanned aircraft, a drone, and they say it's been very successful in detecting people trying to cross illegally. So the Border Patrol was hoping to get another 6, and those 6 are listed in the legislation. Those are over $9 million each. Now, I should say that there is an out in the bill that allows Homeland Secretary Janet Napolitano to substitute equivalent or better technology than the items listed. But watchdogs really feel that it's incredibly problematic to list specific equipment in legislation because it really puts pressure on an agency to actually go through with purchasing those items.
The shopping list is long here, even beyond those, of 4,595 ground sensors, 104 radiation isotope identification devices, 53 fiber optic tank inspection scopes. I guess that means for gas tank or something like that. I mean, it's pretty amazing. And then there's $7.5 billion to build 350 miles, more miles of fencing. Do you know where that would go, Mateo?
Well, they haven't determined the specific, you know,
just put it up somewhere.
Right. But I think a key point to make is that the bulk of this $38 billion, $30 billion, would be used to hire 20,000 new Border Patrol agents. And this is a pretty controversial idea among immigration experts. It's very hard to find anyone who advocates for this kind of doubling of the Border Patrol. A lot of folks said that this is something that, you know, could be incredibly problematic. One, it's not really needed, they say. Secondly, you could have this pressure to recruit and train so many many new agents that you could end up bringing in a lot of people into the force who aren't really prepared or skilled enough to be there, and which is something that happened the last time the Border Patrol doubled in size since 2004. And they say a lot of these resources could be better spent domestically, internally, enforcing immigration laws through workplace inspections or beefing up the e-verify system for employers to check the citizenship status of their applicants. And so there's a lot of controversy about how these resources are allocated in the Senate bill, and I think it's probably all going to be open for debate when it goes over to the House.
But the symbolism of ferocity at the border seemed to be important to get the votes on board. I mean, as you remind us, Border Patrol already has a record 21,000 agents, up from 10,000 just back in 2004. And in its most recent budget request, the department did not seek any new agents. They're almost going to double. Senator Patrick Leahy out of Vermont says the border security measure reads like a Christmas wish list for Halliburton. What about when this goes to the House? I mean, there are the same political dynamics in some respects there. On the other hand, there's great sensitivity about spending. Where do you think it may go, Mateo?
Yeah, well, that's why I think this part of the bill will be very controversial. I mean, they're the kind of the Tea Party caucus in the House. There's a real strong populist sentiment, and this idea of spending these huge sums of money going to defense contractors and just federal budget spending in general is frowned upon. So that part of the bill is really going to be difficult to get through. But I think probably the bigger challenge in the House is just purely the basic premise of creating a path for citizenship for people who do not have legal documents. That is still a serious debate in the House, and there's nowhere near the kind of consensus that is needed as there was in the Senate.
Mateo Gold, staff writer for The Washington Post, covers money and politics, and most recently, the enormous budget or border security package passed by the U.S. Senate. Now it's headed on its way to the House. Mateo, wonderful to have you with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, great to be here, Tom. Thank you so much.
Listeners, you can find a link to that terrific piece of reporting by Mateo at our website, onpointradio.org. Tune in tomorrow. We've got the amazing story of the intrepid photographer who captured the last old ways of the Apache, the Hopi, the Sioux, Native Americans on film. You can continue all our conversations and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR at Twitter. On Point has got a terrific team of producers: Emily Alphen Johnson, Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, Dean Russell. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.